From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's an idea that America is a country of wanderers, that our cities and institutions were created by restless explorers and pioneers who stepped from the threshold of home and never looked back. And there is some truth to that. But in her book, the historian Susan Matt says Americans haven't always had an easy time leaving home. Her book is an exploration of homesickness, how we went from being a society of content homebodies to a culture that sees homesickness as a lack of curiosity or ambition. Today in the program, Susan Matt will join us to talk about the history of homesickness and how even in an age of communication and social networks, we still long for home. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You ever feel guilty about just wanting to stay home? Turns out that's a particular element of the American character, wanting to stay put but worrying what it might say about you. The historian Susan Matt says there was a time when the love of home was the mark of a refined and sensitive nature, but over the years, something changed. And if you confessed to being homesick, you were considered maladjusted, unsophisticated. It was the mark of a childish nature. Susan Matt says homesickness represents the fullness of the American experience. Throughout our history, she says, we've struggled with this emotion. In fact, she says, we've had to learn the habits of mobility and individualism. Today in the program, Susan Matt is joining us to talk about America's conflicted feelings about home, how we went from being a society of content homebodies to a culture that sees homesickness as a lack of curiosity or ambition. Also today, we're asking this question, can you ever really go home again? The book is called Homesickness in American History. Susan Matt is a professor of history and the department chair at Weber State University. She previously wrote a book about envy in American consumer society called Keeping Up with the Joneses. And she's joining us here in the studio. And Susan Matt, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, I wanted to begin, I guess the most obvious question is, what got you thinking about this idea, this story?
Well, I moved to Utah in 1999 and I had been looking forward to moving west for years, but once I got here, I realized how far away my parents and sister were in the Midwest, and I thought, am I the only person who's been optimistic about westward migration and then had ambivalence once I arrived?
Yeah.
So,
Wait, so you're saying what got you started writing a book about homesickness was a feeling of homesickness?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I wanted to explain away my own pathology by making it a larger cultural problem.
What do you think homesickness says about human nature? I mean, do you the feelings that you felt when you left home? You know, you were a grown-up and all of that. I mean, have we evolved as a species, for example? I won't ask you to talk about biology, but do you think as human as sort of an element of our human nature, are we evolved to wander or to stay put once we find a home?
I think people have found it more difficult to wander than our modern mythologies would make us expect. And I'm not a biologist. I don't know the answer to that. But I think we're told in American society, move, go west. And in reality, a lot of people are much more content staying close to family, close to where they came from. And that was the pattern for human history for generations, for centuries. So the American mobility of the last few centuries is the exception, not the rule.
Right. We had the storyteller Kevin Kling on the show, and he had written that each of us is drawn to a geography. And he says that for all of us, there's a place that provides solace and awakens our muse. That's home. Do you have a sense that we all feel connected to some kind of place? No matter where we end up, we all sort of feel connected to home.
Yeah, and it may not be the place you were born, but it's some place you identify with that formed you as an individual and gave you an identity. So it could be some place you lived in your 20s. That certainly was one of the places I felt like home was Ithaca, New York. And Utah's becoming more home-like all the time.
Yeah, is it? You feeling like this might be home?
Well, you know, it's one of those things when I fly back to see my family in the Midwest, I'm not sure I'm home there anymore. When I come back here, I feel this is where my life is, but it's not quite home either.
In the book, you say that for a long time, scholars figured when you're studying the past, emotions are tangential. Was this a dicey thing to take on as a scholar, the idea of an emotion, or have we settled that it's okay now to write about this, study this, talk about it?
Increasingly, there are more studies of the emotions than there were maybe 10 or 15 years ago. People used to say, we study people, they're rational actors. We look at the external behavior they show.
Yeah.
Who cares about what's going on in their heads? To me, that's the important story. You don't get what's going on if you don't know why people are moving, what their hopes are. And that's certainly the case with homesickness, that you can see all these people heading west, and so often what they're thinking about is, I can't wait till I get back east. That was the case with gold miners, with yeah. prospectors, with pioneers. So,
well, how many songs are written about home?
It becomes the most popular theme in 19th century songs, and the 19th century is the most mobile era of American history. 1800 to 1850, almost 50% of the population is changing state lines, crossing state lines, and Home Sweet Home is the number one song in America and stays that way for decades.
Wow. You say that homesickness became a kind of taboo subject because of it. It's not this category that people have used to assess society or the past. What do you mean it was a taboo subject?
In the last century, at least, it's disappeared from official histories of America. Maybe even longer than that, 150 years.
Wow.
If you go and look in archives, if you look in diaries, if you look in journals, Americans are constantly writing home, writing to their families, writing to their mothers. I wish I could be with you. If I don't see you again on earth, I hope I see you in heaven, because that's how much I want to be with you.
Yeah.
And that's nowhere in the historical record. So it became a taboo subject in history. It became a taboo subject in psychology, where modern psychology does not deal with adult homesickness. It only deals with children's homesickness. You're supposed to go through this stage at summer camp or at college and then move on and be a modern, mature capitalist, and you're ready for the world.
So this is a reflection then of this idea that homesickness is not a virtue. And we'll talk more particular about all of this. It's a malady. It's a problem. It's a defect.
Yeah. And for 19th century Americans, they saw that it could cause some problems. But they looked at people who loved home and said, of course you love home. You are a good person if you love home. And particularly for Victorians, mother and home were the central moral values. So you'd be flawed if you didn't miss it. And we've kind of come the other way, where if you miss it too much, you're a mama's boy, you're a sissy, you're a prissy, you're a baby.
Yeah.
And those are all insults today.
So talk more a little bit about what the modern attitude of homesickness. As I understand it, it's this idea that, look, we are a mobile country. We are on the move. This idea of getting out of, these crummy hometowns, that's what we're about. We want to get out of here. In fact, I want to actually – there's a moment from a Frank Capra film, It's a Wonderful Life. I actually want to play a clip here. Because it seems to me that it kind of reflects, when I was reading the book, it reflects a certain attitude about home. It's the scene where George and Mary are walking home. People are familiar with it if they know the film. And they're throwing rocks into this old building and they make a wish. And in this particular scene, George has just thrown his rock.
What'd you wish, George?
Well, not just one wish, a whole hatful. Mary, I know what I'm going to do tomorrow and the next day and next year and the year after that. I'm shaking the dust of this crummy little town off my feet and I'm going to see the world. Italy, Greece, the Parthenon, the Colosseum. Then I'm coming back here and go to college and see what they know. And then I'm going to build things. I'm going to build airfields. I'm going to build skyscrapers 100 stories high. I'm going to build bridges a mile long. Were you going to throw a rock? Hey, that's pretty good. What'd you wish, Mary?
Buffalo gals, can't you come out tonight?
Tonight, can't you come out tonight? Can't you come out tonight?
Buffalo gals, can't...
Seems like that scene reflects that kind of conflict that was going on. On the one hand, you have this character who wants to, as he said, shake the dust off this crummy little town. And then there's Mary, though, who likes this crummy little town. Is there a conflict in our American culture about the ideas of home?
Absolutely. To want to stay home shows that you're not cosmopolitan. You're not part of the national economy, the world economy. You're not well-traveled. You're not ambitious.
Yeah.
And increasingly from the late 19th century on, if you wanted to stay too closely rooted to where you came, that showed you just weren't independent with initiative. On the other hand, Mary is so typical of 19th century and at least some part of 20th century America. So often it was the husbands who wanted to set off, and women who were more tethered by domestic obligations, who were supposed to be submissive to their husbands, didn't have much say in the matter. So you see in many of the westward migration stories and journals and letters, the women are kind of kicking and screaming the whole way west, wanting to stay put. And the men may be a little bit more forward-looking, optimistic in their travels.
Yeah. But that was the myth, right? I mean, that was the myth that we and it wasn't always so. I mean, I think that's the point sort of we want to get to, which we'll work through, which is there was a long time in human history, not just American history, when we felt like, gosh, this is pretty nice being home. I think this is pretty great.
Right. And I think even from the very moment America became a European or Europeans started to colonize America,
yeah,
you see people uncomfortable with the fact that they've traveled so far from home. So some of our very founding myths, which are based on the idea that mobility is natural, are actually just that. They're myths. So many of the people who come to Jamestown or Puritan Massachusetts are coming there to make money so they can go back home and live the life they really want, which is a richer, more prosperous life in England or in Spain or in France. And a significant number actually do return to do that. So I think we have to see a lot of people's migrations in America as a way to get back home.
Yeah. The book, a lot of the book is about individualism, the sort of the myth of individualism. And as you write, how we kind of learned this idea of individualism. You talk about that the history of homesickness reveals how Americans learned the habits of individualism that kind of supported capitalistic societies. Talk about that idea.
Well, you read commentators on American society like Alexis de Tocqueville or Frederick Jackson Turner, and they always say individualism is the dominant fact, and this is what has made America what it is.
Yeah.
And when you actually look at how people feel about the most fundamental act of being an individual, leaving home, separating from family, moving on, people aren't all that comfortable with it for a large section of American history. And so I think we may have misread our history by focusing so much on the external behavior of movement rather than on that internal set of motivations that drove them to migrate. And I think we've learned to assume a certain set of behaviors and an emotional style.
Emotional code is how you put it in the book.
Yeah, an emotional code that says repress homesickness, express optimism, express cheerfulness, move forward, don't look back. And so that's the external behavior, but that's not what people are thinking as they're doing those things.
So is there a lot of do we still feel a lot of guilt about saying, man, I really miss home?
Well, I opened the book with an anecdote of a woman going to a manicurist in New York City and confessing that she feels homesick because she's just moved from Minneapolis to New York City. And the manicurist is a Korean woman who barks up an uppercase admonition, don't be big baby.
Yeah.
And
right.
I think that's sort of the outlook that a lot of people have learned either by expressing it and being chastised for expressing it or have learned from other cues in our culture that you can't be that public. People will think you're maladapted to modern society.
Susan Matt is with us. She's a professor of history and the department chair at Weber State University. Her book is called Homesickness in American History. I'm going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're talking about homesickness, that longing for the familiar comforts and faces of home. Our guest is the historian Susan Matt, who's written a book that explores all the ways we Americans have missed home over the years. It used to be that we were proud to be called homebodies. Wanting to stay close didn't mean you lacked ambition or curiosity. You just felt like you belonged somewhere. But over time, being homesick has come to be seen as childish, an obstacle to becoming successful and independent. Now our attitudes may be changing and shifting back, and we're talking about all of this with Susan Matt, her book, Homesickness in American History. When do we first see the word homesickness? When does that first emerge?
It comes into the English language in the 1750s and comes to England and then very quickly crosses the Atlantic and is in very common use by the 1760s, 1770s, which to me indicates that there was this widespread feeling that needed a name and caught on with remarkable speed.
Homesickness, was it always connected to the idea of nostalgia? Are those two ideas connected?
Particularly at the outset, nostalgia is a word that gets created in 1688 by a Swiss scholar who's trying to describe what he sees around him as people begin to travel a little farther from home. And he's talking about distances like 60 miles.
Right.
So he writes a dissertation about all these cases. One is a medical student who's gone from Bern, Switzerland to Basel and is at death's door. And then at the last minute is carried by hospital litter back over the mountains to Bern and miraculously revives. And Johannes Hofer decides this condition is worthy of a Greek name. And he makes up the word nostalgia. And so we think it's this word that's been around forever. But it originally meant that longing for home. Today we think of it more as a longing for a lost time.
Yeah.
But then it was –
it was about a particular place.
Yeah, yeah. And it works as a diagnosis across Europe in the 17th and 18th centuries. It comes to America right around the Revolution. And all through the 19th century, people are being diagnosed with and dying of nostalgia in America. The Surgeon General uses it. The Army uses it as a disease category. It's kind of weird to see it in the Surgeon General's records that 74 men died of nostalgia. But that's what the Civil War records say.
The Civil War is an important part of this too, I think, because some of the letters that you – if you think about any of the letters that you may have seen from Civil War soldiers, they were all about home, all about connecting, all about longing for that place.
And Americans, whether they're in the military or on the home front, are so aware of the fact that close to 3 million men are away from home, many of them for the first time. So there'll be Currier and Ives, lithographs, all the stationery that gets produced for Civil War soldiers has men sleeping on army cots dreaming of home. And then those letters themselves are just full of longing. And sometimes the men will say, I'm not homesick, but I really miss home, because they feel that they have to keep some, I don't know, manly image up. But a lot of times they're just pretty weepy missives they're sending.
Yes. Let's take a call. Brad is with us in Centerville. Brad, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Curiously enough, I'm in the military, and I wanted to share with you the first move that I made with my family. When we moved from Utah to Connecticut, and it's a very different culture up there as far as personalities. My wife was incredibly homesick, and it wasn't until spring where it was warm enough to go outside and experience Connecticut did we realize how cool Connecticut could be. And once we discovered that, you know, the way to avoid homesick is not sit in Connecticut thinking about how it's not like Utah, we actually got out and started to discover what made Connecticut cool. And we've moved four other times since then. And each time we've moved, instead of focusing on, you know, is this place going to be like anywhere else, we focus really on what makes this place cool, and then how can we get all that stuff done before we have to move again.
it's a dilemma for people in the military. They have to have these coping mechanisms to deal with homesickness.
And a lot of people I've talked to who either are military active duty members themselves or children of military are the people who seem to have either conquered homesickness and feel it no more, or have the best coping strategies. So they've learned to look forward. They've learned to put down temporary roots. One thing I think modern Americans are pretty good at is making every place feel like home. You learn a set of techniques. So you learn how to put your furniture in the same place or buy old-fashioned looking furniture that makes it look like you and your ancestors have been there forever. I don't know if those are any of the techniques Brad used, but certainly this idea of learning to move on is something 20th century and 21st century Americans have had to do.
And a huge theme for immigrants. I mean, how many Little Italys are there in, you know, urban cities throughout the country and Chinatowns throughout? I mean, that's a recreation of home.
Absolutely. And people are going to really extreme lengths sometimes. I think if you're not a member of the community, maybe you can't see it. But people have their priests from little towns in Mexico where they came from come up and do baptisms, come up and do weddings.
Yeah.
In New York or Los Angeles or Minnesota. And so there's sort of a northern congregation and a southern congregation. You'll have people publishing newspapers. You'll have all sorts of hometown associations. There are Mexican hometown associations. There were Jewish, there were Polish, there were Italian ones where people from the same little village would reconstitute themselves in New York or Salt Lake or Los Angeles.
In the same physical way in many cases.
Yeah, and often they're sending back money to the home village. So home is never absent from their mind, even if they're in this completely strange and foreign location. And they're always trying to improve it back there, which I think is why so many come in the first place.
Yeah. Back to the phones. Mike with us in Layton, Utah. Mike, welcome.
Good morning. Yeah, I just had a question to the author. And the question is really about people move away from home as individuals. For example, you know, soldiers or as families, immigrants. And I wonder if the author has done any research or found in her research a difference, a substantial difference between those individuals who move as individuals versus those who move away but carry their family support system with them. So it helps separate out attachment from place from attachment to people, family.
That's a great question. And I think it's certainly easier if you move with your whole family. But I do find when I read letters from families that not everybody in the family feels the same way about the move. So
sure.
You'll see people moving from the South to what they call the Old Southwest, so Arkansas and Tennessee. And the husbands are saying, we're doing fine. It's great out here. And the wives are saying, I miss my own native hill and I long to see you, mother. And this feels so unnatural. So I think having your family there is an important support, but there was widespread recognition that most wives didn't have a full say in the decision to migrate in the first place and may have had more mixed feelings than they were allowed to express.
I wonder if – Mike, thanks very much for the call, by the way. So we used to see staying home, as you say in the book, as refined. These were sensitive people. Did we look with suspicion on people who wandered?
To some extent, particularly in 19th century America, where people really liked the idea of being able to know you, know who you were, who your parents were, where you came from, have a sense of read on you. To be a stranger brought all sorts of suspicion and mystery. And there are all sorts of 19th century stories about people conning each other, playing upon each other's sympathies, and it's usually someone who comes from an unknown background. So there was a sense that maybe this much mobility isn't a good idea. Maybe we're going to become a bunch of moral backsliders. Maybe we're going to – who knows what's going to happen to our society if we move so much. There won't be any strong or stable supports for it. And there were lots of people who were trying to counteract that in the 19th century. They weren't very successful because people kept moving, but – all sorts of advisors and ministers kept saying, stay put.
You know, one of the groups that I was particularly interested in that you write about were African slaves, of course, who longed to return home, built songs and traditions and ideas about home. And in some ways, as you put it in the book, the only way they could return home was through these sort of supernatural means.
Yeah, that was some of the most moving material I found in all my research was how slaves, particularly newly captured African slaves, so that first generation feeling the shock of moving from their own society across the ocean to a foreign land, dealt with that displacement. And the record is just rife with suicide. So people are throwing themselves overboard in the middle of the ocean with the belief that the waters will transport their souls back to Africa and they can be reunited with their families. Once they get to America, people use all sorts of methods to kill themselves, hanging, walking into water, slicing their bellies open. There are lots and lots of records of these suicides, and people are pretty explicit that their hope is that they'll get back to Africa. And there are even some people who aren't willing to kill themselves but make extraordinary efforts to, like, runaway slaves in Georgia who take a canoe down the Ogeechee River and try to paddle across the Atlantic. It's a futile effort, but it's so moving and heartbreaking.
What's so kind of disappointing about that is the deep feelings that white culture has about home and how it didn't seem to bother us, the slave predicament, not to mention, as you write about in the book, that we displaced, you know, perhaps hundreds of thousands of Native Americans from their homes.
Yeah, there's a belief that both African Americans and Native Americans had less refined, less sensitive natures. So there was no way they could experience the pain of parting. So you'll see in slavery, families splintered apart, mothers sold away from children. Whites often just say, well, they don't feel it. They don't know what's going on. They're not the same as we are. One interesting side note on that is so many of the slaves who are running away in the 19th century, we always think of them following the North Star to freedom, but a lot of them are running south or east or west to run back to their families, which goes against a lot of our narratives. And as for the Native Americans, you know, Andrew Jackson will say there's no way they can feel the pain we do as he pushes the Cherokee and the other so-called civilized tribes west. There's no way they can feel it. White Americans move all the time, and I don't believe that Native Americans are going to feel the same pain as what he writes. So kind of shocking disregard for others.
Yeah. Another one of those ironic moments of history.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones. Tara with us in Salt Lake City. Tara, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So just listening to this conversation, I thought of my own first experience with being homesick and how interesting it was to me because my mom, she encouraged me and got me excited about leaving home and going to college. It was an exciting adventure. And so I went to a school about 4 hours away. And that first Sunday, myself, I just had this really intense feeling of missing home and my family. It was a weird thing, the fact that there weren't any Sunday comics to flip through was what kind of triggered it. And so I just thought it was interesting since I was encouraged to go have that big adventure.
But there was it's interesting the comics were a trigger for you.
Yeah. There wasn't a Sunday paper in our little dorm. And so I just really missed home at that point.
Well, Susan, there have to be all kinds of little triggers related to food, probably, or rituals, all kinds of things like that.
Well, and newspapers are so interesting that she mentions that because the newspaper you read is kind of a sign of what you think is home and what news you want. And so the comics are part of that, too. And, you know, you see gold miners in California who would pay $20 to read an old Boston newspaper. It doesn't matter how out of date because that's where home is. So if you don't get your comics or you don't get your Boston news, you're not going to feel like you're part of home anymore. Then there are triggers like food, and food is such a trigger for memory. That's one of the things that immigrants start importing in massive quantities in the late 19th century by steamship. And that seems to bring enormous, at least temporary relief that you can have the same cheese, the same olives, the same wine, the same rice. Asian immigrants are bringing in millions of pounds of rice a year to have the same diets they enjoyed in China and Japan.
It's a connection to home.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that surprised me, and you write about, which, and we'll sort of get to more sort of 21st century ideas, but I had not thought of it this way, but in some ways, some people sort of regard the homogenization of brands and, you know, that there's an Applebee's in Indiana as well as there is in Farmington, Utah or whatever, as a bad thing. But in some ways, You write about the fact that people draw comfort from that familiarity is about looking for home in a place when you don't feel like you're at home.
I was surprised by that too because I had always thought, you know, these are the stores that are making our places anonymous and interchangeable and lacking character. But I had a real revelation. I was interviewing a returned Mexican immigrant. He'd come back to Mexico, and I was down there interviewing him. And I said, you know, were there stores you went to that reminded you of home? And he said, yeah, I went to Walmart when I was in Pahrump, Nevada. Hmm. And that was what connected me to home, because I always went to the Walmart in Guadalajara. Wow. And so I thought, well, that's so interesting that these things that I think are making the world anonymous actually are in some ways knitting it together. And it made me have to rethink some of my fundamental assumptions.
Tara, thanks. Back to the phone. Zach is with us in Springville, Utah. Zach, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. No, I was actually going to comment on the homogenization, but after your comment, I'm wondering, doesn't that sort of make the word home feel a little more empty? I mean, if everything is homogenized and there is nothing distinct about home, is that sort of just maybe a shallow coping mechanism for the fact that we're not used to being so rootless in a kind of a modern context? Mm-hmm. And I wonder, all of this, you know, corporate sheen that sits on top of the land, do you think it's affected our connection to the physical land of home itself? I mean, because most of us don't experience the land we live in. We experience the street and Applebee's and Walmart.
Wait, hold on, Zach. What's home for you then? How do you define home?
Well, for me, home is in my heart, home is Canada, where I'm from, and it's that sense of the people I knew and the land that I lived in, and I just felt attached to that place. But it wasn't like I guess I feel attached to the things that weren't sort of corporate, you know, cookie cutter things. They were the things that were distinct.
Yeah. What do you think about that? That's so interesting, because Zach's not having this idea that Walmart is in any way home.
Well, and, you know, I share that sense with him that it makes the landscape ugly and keeps us from seeing the true things that would connect us. I think we have to admit that sometimes consumer goods, commercial objects do help people, that you can have a McDonald's anywhere may make you feel like you're in a more familiar world. But I don't think those things are ever going to replace the really particular and specific things that tie us to people or places. And so, for instance, the immigrant I mentioned, you know, Walmart brought him only so much relief, and eventually he went back to Guadalajara. And, you know, there were a million other things that were more important to him than that connection. So I think the corporate culture that's global and worldwide may assuage homesickness. It really doesn't cure it, and people really long for particular, not generic, things like those chains.
Zach, thanks very much. Dennis is with us in Farmington, Utah. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I have a question regarding, like, the Trail of Tears and the Mormon migration, where the entire community moved. What kind of effect does that have, where you're only changing geography, but everybody you ever known goes with you?
Hmm. That's a great question.
I think it does help to some degree. But, you know, there are so many other things people are connected to, and some of the Cherokee, in fact, end up staying behind. So not the whole community goes, but a significant portion. And you just hear these accounts of the Cherokee bursting into tears and almost having to be ripped from the land by those soldiers who are removing them. So even if they're going with family, they have these other bonds to place that also contribute to their sense of home and can't be taken with them. On the Mormon migration, I think another element that changes the dynamic there a little bit is the sense that people are responding to God's calling. Yeah. And so you can kind of comfort yourself that, yeah, you miss home, but you've got this divine purpose. That helps, but that doesn't eradicate homesickness either. And you see in all the religious migrations, whether it's the Puritans or the Mormons, that some people really do want to go home, and some of them actually do.
Well, isn't this why we have tamarisk along stream beds and Kentucky bluegrass and certain types of, you know, plants that aren't indigenous to this place, that they were trying to recreate their home, even though God told them to be here? They want it to look more like
New England.
Yeah.
And you look at lilacs and magnolias and all the trees that, yeah, really aren't suited for this landscape, but couldn't be forgotten and came often in people's saddlebags. People would bring vines, seeds with them to replant here. That was a very common thing to mail to each other across the distance too. So the plants were very important.
Yeah. Here's an email from Tara, who writes from Salt Lake City. My grandparents and great-grandparents left Ireland and Italy I think that their departure, she writes, led my parents to leave the East Coast for the West Coast. The restlessness has continued to pass down generational lines, and we have a family diaspora. I now live in Utah. My mom lives in Arizona, my sister in Nevada, another sister in Nicaragua. I have a deep-seated longing for family and place, and yet I still think of resettling. Is this the American dichotomy?
I think that does sum it up, that we're always looking to other places with optimism and hope that the grass is greener there. And we're encouraged to do so. That's part of our capitalist, individualist ideology. That ideology has so often suppressed the idea that maybe there is an emotional cost to that movement. Maybe there's an emotional toll. So your longing for place, even as you think about resettling, seems to me the very crux of American mobility and restlessness. And certainly, you know, when you look at 19th century settlers or immigrants, they're having the same mixed feelings. Mm. And our history is a lot more mixed.
Here's an email from Dan, who writes from Brigham City. I am retired Air Force, but even growing up, I moved frequently, so I find that I get stir crazy if I'm in one place for too long. I've been here in Utah now for 12 years, just took a job out of state because it was way past time for me to move. Ryan writes this, I remember my parents dropping me off to my new apartment, four roommates for my second year of college, and being shocked that I had no foreshadowing of the homesickness that I immediately felt, especially since a couple of hours earlier I was excited. Ryan writes that I realize now that there are certain emotions that simply do not ease themselves into existence, but rather hit hard and hit immediate. Homesickness, he writes, is one of those emotions. I can't effectively prepare for it, even when I know it's coming.
Yeah. And, you know, I never felt homesickness as a kid. And so I didn't even know that's what I was feeling until I started to think about it once I was out here.
Susan Matt is with us. She's the author of the book Homesickness and American History. And we've got to take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with historian Susan Matt. We're talking about her book, Homesickness in American History. So when did, if we're fairly content with home, when did the switch really happen? I guess it was pretty gradual. It wasn't exactly a switch. But at some point over the past 100 years or so, we started to idealize the idea of leaving home. How did that happen?
Well, I think part of it was that people had been leaving home for a long time in America, but with these mixed feelings. They'd gotten sympathy for those mixed feelings up through, the late 19th century. And then there were a couple developments. One was the rise of social Darwinism, which suggested that if you couldn't adapt to a new environment, you were kind of an inferior species, and homesickness is a sign of lack of adaptation. Another change was the massive industrialization and urbanization of America, which seemed to draw people from farms into cities, drew people across oceans to America, and made mobility seem even more necessary than it had been in years previous. And finally, the rise of modern psychology, which suggested that people could become overly bonded to their parents and that parents were the problem, particularly mothers.
Very Spock, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was Dr. Spock picked up on this. It was even, you know, a few decades before him, the behaviorist psychologist John Watson suggested mothers should never hug their children and should just shake hands with them so they'd learn to be, you know, distant and could cut ties easily. And that became a huge thing during World War II, that there was too much smother love and mothers were America's gravest menace because they were making mama's boys.
There's a poster in your book. Which sort of goes to that, you know, leave my baby alone or whatever it is.
Yeah, don't take my darling son alone.
That's it.
And that's a World War I piece of sheet music. And that was perfectly fine to say in World War I. By World War II or the Korean War, they would say, this mother is criminal. She's ruining her son. He's going to be unfit for military duty. He's going to be unfit to go off and fight the wars. He's going to be unfit to go work for the modern corporations that are dominating the American economy in the 1950s. You know, what a psychological nightmare she is.
And what a change in just a few decades, really.
Yeah, it all came together pretty quickly once the 20th century hit. And I think it was this pretty potent combination of psychology, philosophy, and just economic, massive economic change.
When did we start to see people who stayed home? Like, for example, people who go to their high school reunion. You know, a lot of the times the judgment is for those who, in some places, who stayed put. You know, they worked at the family business, or they're still there. You see in American popular culture, a lot of films, for example, that is sort of some sort of pathetic reflection of your sad life, that you didn't go anywhere. When did that come to be?
I would say that's definitely a 20th century phenomenon. Right at the start of the 20th century, you see all these young, ambitious men starting out 1890s, 1900s, leaving their farms for the city, and that becomes the new icon of success. And in fact, the most popular painting in America is the painting that's on the front of the book, Breaking Home Ties, which shows a young man about to set off from his country home for the city. And this is one of the first paintings that doesn't have any sort of moral trepidation about his journey away from home. There's not going to be a problem. He's going to be fine. He's going to land on his feet. He's going to be a success. And that's a shift that's happening in the 1890s.
Back to the phones. Let's see. Jim is with us in Salt Lake. Jim, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Sure. And trying to put together going on the Wayback Machine for a minute, or trying to put together the evolutionary biological origins of where we might have a greater attachment, whether it's to geography or to sociology. I think when we were a gatherer, hunter, forager type society, I think every time we moved, we moved with that group of 50 to 200 people that we were familiar with. And occasionally marriages, you know, were arranged outside the group, but those are very, very specific. But in general, we moved around. And if we moved through geography, which I like to move from the mountains in the winter to the plains in the summer, that was a pretty fairly abrupt change in scene, which we were adapted to, but we always had those same people with us.
Yeah, you confessed earlier not to being a biologist, but I mean, what do you think about that? We talked a little bit about it earlier.
Well, and I think people migrated when they went from the mountains down to the valleys. From as the seasons changed, they went to pretty much the same places over and over again. So they weren't leaving their home in these sort of nomadic wanderings so much as going back and forth between two homes. So there was still a sense of place that was permanent in these people's lives. They weren't randomly moving, but felt pretty connected to the land.
Jim, thanks very much. Richard with us in Salt Lake City. Richard, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
I recently read a book about the early days of European conquest, and it talked how knights and other members of royalty would gather up entire villages to take with them on crusades or other battles. And then when the battle was over, it would just release the individuals. Well, these people had never been further away from home than 5 miles, had no idea where they were, had no idea where home was, and 9 times out of 10 didn't even speak the language of the location where they were dumped. I wondered if the author had any comment on the kind of forced location where entire villages were gathered up, used, and then dropped out. Do they tend to regather and try to recreate a home together, or are they just too far away from home to be able to do that?
I don't know so much about the early modern European examples you give, but we have some examples in America like Vietnamese refugees or Cuban refugees who seem to reconstitute the same towns that they lived in or try to. I have a section about Vietnamese refugees coming to America, and government policies tried to scatter them so that you wouldn't have too many new people adjusting in one state and becoming a burden to the state. And you'll see people circumvent those policies and move back to be with folks they know halfway across the country. So as I can't speak to your example, but I think that's a tendency that you're going to try to find people from your town, from your region in a strange environment.
What are we seeing in the 21st century now? Where's the evolution now? Do we still look down on the idea of homesickness? You still talk about it. It's still in the literature. I mean, you still hear those sort of tut-tutting of professionals and others about people who stay put. Have we changed much? Are we changing?
Well, I think our psychology books don't change much. So you still hear psychologists condemning children who talk to their parents too much from college on cell phones or Facebook or email, texting, that they're going to be over-dependent and somehow not have that rugged pioneer individualism that made America great. And once again, there's that fear that we're raising a generation of sissies. So the psychological advice, the child-rearing advice hasn't changed. But in terms of our practices, I think families are really making every effort to stay in touch across the miles despite all these dire warnings they're receiving. And so there's a little bit of a rebellion just in terms of daily life, how much people are connected. One study showed that during college, students talk to their parents 13 times a week and after college 16 times a week.
Wow.
So I don't think we're following the advice. I also think if you look at mobility rates, mobility is way down from its height. It's at about 11% of the population moves each year compared to almost 20% in the 1950s and 1980s. So we're more place-bound. Part of that's economic, but
sure.
Part of that's also sort of, I think, a growing appreciation of home, of place, of roots.
And all this technology, which goes to what you were talking about earlier, I mean, a lot of people think it's disconnecting us. It's pulling us apart. Your argument is kind of the contrary, at least in some ways. It's making us more connected to home.
Yeah. You know, I have so many mixed feelings about iPads and iPhones. And
everyone does.
But you watch people text maniacally on them. On the one hand, you go, tut, tut. But on the other hand, I think of descriptions of Civil War soldiers where people would say, you know, 100 soldiers would be gathered, each in their own corner, writing a letter to their mother. And I'm just not sure that texting is that much different or emailing is that much different. We're doing it with new technologies, but the desire to stay in touch is still manifesting itself. So I think when you look at immigrants, when you look at the military, when you look at children separated from their parents, they're all using these technologies to deal with homesickness. I don't think they'll cure homesickness, though.
You know, we asked the question I wanted to get at, which is, can you ever really go home again? And you know, we've been defining home in very particular ways throughout this show. I mean, people are looking at it in sort of evolutionary ways. But in that sense of the idea of can you go home, home becomes less a place as an idea in some ways, as a kind of a time. And in some ways, you can't really get back there.
Well, and I think that's where homesickness and nostalgia begin to split. So those two words mean the same thing for much of American history. And only in the 1950s do you see this modern sense of nostalgia, a longing for a lost time, come into being. And I think that's related to the fact that when people actually do start going to the homes they've been homesick for, they realize they can't get back to them. And you first find accounts of this when the Transcontinental Railroad connects California with New England, or people can take the steamship back to Italy, and they've been longing for these places for decades. And they get there and they're not the same. And sometimes they come back to America from Italy or back to California from New England. And there they're having this moment of what we would now call nostalgia. They
right.
thought they were homesick, but what they realize is they weren't longing for a lost place. They were longing for a lost time.
Another
and they
time.
Can't get there.
Which is why I guess there are those of us who have this affection for, you know, vinyl records and vintage clothing and a lot of retro stuff. That's not a reflection of home, but that's a reflection of trying to connect to another era, another time.
Yeah, and I think particularly if you're mobile, those may be very comforting because you can surround yourself with all these memories of the past, which kind of create a fictive past for you that you occupied this space for a long time because you've got all this old stuff. I think that's why restoration hardware was so popular, and Martha Stewart and all these kind of retro nostalgia goods. They help you create a domestic life full of vinyl records or what have you that connect you to the past and make you feel grounded, even if you just loaded them up in the U-Haul and moved into your new apartment last week.
Here's an email from Susan who writes, I moved to Utah from the Midwest about 18 years ago. I always thought I'd go home, but circumstances interfered with those plans. Of course, I found friends and the love of my life in the Intermountain West. There are times when I still miss home, though, the sounds, the smells, the deep connection to my family history. I often feel like I can't express it, though, that saying I miss home may be equated by my husband to saying I'm not happy right where I am. I am happy, she writes, but as they say, you can take the girl out of Indiana, but you can't take Indiana out of the girl.
That's a nice comment. And I think that perfectly captures that ambivalence that so many people who've moved feel.
Let me ask you, there's the actor and playwright Philip Slater wrote this book called The Pursuit of Loneliness, and you quote something that he says, which deals with this idea that we train ourselves to be independent. Independence training in American society begins at birth. Babies are held and carried less than in most societies, spend more time in complete isolation, that we're trying to live up to this myth. But is that where we are now? Are you seeing any movement in that? Are we still training ourselves to be independent?
I think it's still a goal, certainly, and people growing up on Dr. Spock and then the more modern versions of Dr. Spock still have that idea that their kids should leave home, learn to separate. And so on the one hand, it's in the parenting literature. It's in Sesame Street. Sesame Street has endless books. Arthur the Aardvark has endless books about teaching you to go away from home and not be too dependent on anyone and have kind of loose ties that are casual that you can reestablish with someone else. So I think we have this kind of set of social prescriptions that are pushing us in one direction. But I do see that there's a more vocal desire for place. There's a more vocal desire to stay put. And there's a lot more people actually resisting relocation. So in one study, 53% of people said they wouldn't move when their companies asked them to.
Susan Matt, her book is called Homesickness in American History. Joined us here in the studio. She's a professor of history at Weber State University. Thank you very much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.